We go from one great wordsmith to another, and now I'm delighted to welcome to the show the poet and author, Dhiren Ní Gcrích. Good morning, Dhiren.
Good morning, Brendan.
And Dhiren, people will know your poetry, or maybe a lot of people will know your book, A Ghost in the Throat, which won all the prizes a few years ago. It was a huge success. But the reason we're speaking today is because there's a new documentary about you, and it's called Aisling Trinalev, or Clouded Reveries. And I suppose it's kind of the story of how you became a writer. But you originally wanted to be a dentist, which I always think is one of the most horrible of jobs. Why did you want to be a dentist?
I think it was the idea of there being this stable job where you'd go in, there'd be a certain amount of tasks you'd do in the day, and then you'd come home and your day's work would be done. It was a really naive understanding of what dentistry is, like through the eyes of a 17-year-old. But yeah, I thought it would be class.
Yeah, and but then watching the documentary, you very clearly are a writer because you look like you're one of those people. You feel things kind of intensely and sensitive to vibes and places and stuff like that. When did you realise that you were actually a writer?
I mean, it's kind of a strange story. I didn't come to writing until I was in my mid-20s and I'd had my first child. I was on maternity leave. At that stage, I was working as a primary school teacher. And I was on maternity leave and my grandfather was about to pass away. And he was just such a lovely man, Brendan. He was one of those men who's so gentle and kind. And he had a really special relationship with all of his grandchildren. So when we got that call, we all hurried up to Dublin to be there with him, you know. And I brought my baby with me. I was on my own as I came up. And when we got the call in the middle of the night to be by his bedside that he was coming towards the end, it was kind of felt by the family that it wouldn't really be appropriate to have a baby there, which I can totally understand now. Yeah. But I mean, at the time, oh, jeez, I was gutted. I was so upset. And so I was in my Aunt Eileen's house all on my own with the baby and trying to get him to sleep. And just these lines of poetry came to me, which, and I can't overemphasize how bizarre that was, because I wasn't the kind of person who was doing any kind of creative writing in my spare time or anything like that. It felt really like it came out of the blue. And it was very clearly a poem. It was very clearly, like, because it was in kind of in rhyme and it was in the Irish language. And it just felt so strange. And once the baby fell asleep, I remember trying to run around someone else's house looking for pen and paper. Isn't always the easiest thing to find in someone else's house. And I was opening drawers trying to find pen and paper and just really urgently writing this down and just feeling baffled by it. And then kind of taking a second looking at it and saying to myself, that's a poem. And I let myself go with it. And it, like, what's strangest to me now looking back on it is that the following day, and the day after that, and the day after that, and the day after that, I kept going with this, putting pen to paper and just seeing what would happen. And that,
so
this is where it led me.
So the writing kind of became you rather than you becoming a writer in a way.
Yeah, yeah, that's like something I'd say. Now, be careful there, Brendan, you're turning into a poet yourself.
listen, the funny thing is as well, like, you know, the old thing, like, that the pram in the hall, there's no more sombre enemy of good art. But it kind of, the writing came to you at the same time as the children, and you kind of worked it all in there. Like, the domestic is almost kind of sacred in your work, isn't it?
It kind of is. But you see, I suppose it's important to say I've nothing to compare it to. I know it must be really different for people who are writers and then have a baby and they're changing their writing routines around it. Or for anyone who has a baby. I mean, my God, trying to work around this new responsibility is really challenging. But for me, the writing came after the baby. So I was kind of, I always had that sense of like, okay, the baby's asleep. I'm going to run off now and see what happens if I put pen to paper. And oftentimes I would be writing in the same room where, like, the baby would be, like, fast asleep. So for me, the background noise of a lot of my poems, in the meter of the poems, is the idea of this little baby's breath. And I can still almost hear it with some of my poems when I read them aloud. I love that.
And did you really write your book A Ghost in the Throat in a multi-storey car park in Ballincollig?
Yes.
I reckon it's probably the best book ever written in a multi-storey car park in Ballincollig. You know that?
Oh my God. Like, I mean, it's just so funny to acknowledge that. But yeah, that's the truth of it. I used to drive to the roof of the multi-story car park every day after dropping my kids to school and the youngest to play school. And I put a timer on my phone Because sometimes I get so absorbed in the act of writing, I'd forget, you know, and I didn't want to miss going back to the play school for the pickup. So I'd just write furiously for the 3 hours that I'd have there on the roof of the car park. And I, do you know, I was able, because it's the roof of the car park in Ballincollig, it was the only car park there, and it's a free car park.
That was handy. So you were on the clock, but you weren't on the clock financially.
No, I wouldn't have had that now. But I was able to point the car roughly in the direction of the person whose life I was writing about. And that was Eileen Dubhny Connell, in the direction where she lived her married life near Macroom. So I had the sense of looking across this distance between our lives, but also the physical distance between me and the area she would have lived in and been walking through those streets and those townlands in.
Yeah. Just before we come back to her, and look, I don't make you out to be like a 50s housewife or anything, but in the book, you do make a thing of the domestic chores and the ticking off your lists of jobs to be done. It's you make it almost like a kind of a poetry, don't you?
Yeah, I suppose, like with a lot of our books, we're making them from the fabric of our lives, you know, and we're kind of stitching and cutting the fabric from what's given to us of our lives in a lot of ways and what interests us. I'm not the biggest fan of housework, to tell you the truth, but I do a lot of it. So sometimes I would be struck by similarities between my life and this other life that I was attempting to write about, and things that were very, very different between two lives that are situated hundreds of years apart. But then the things that are similar as well, particularly when you're at the stage of life I was at, where you have small children, there are certain things that don't really change with looking after an infant over many, many years. There are a lot of things that do, but there are some things that stay the same. You know, singing a lullaby, rocking a baby to sleep. And they were moments where I felt very close to the woman I was trying to become closer to.
Yeah, and just tell us, for people who don't remember, tell us who Eileen Dubhny Connell was.
So Eileen Dubhny Connell wrote this extraordinary poem, which is called Queen Arthi Lyra. And one thing that I was fascinated by when I found myself coming back to this poem, which was something I would have touched on very briefly in school, was the fact that when she composed that poem, she had been pregnant too. And I was pregnant when I came back to it as an adult. So I felt that kind of connection with her.
Yeah.
And she was pregnant. And this one afternoon, she was at home and she saw her husband's horse return alone without him. And so she jumped in the saddle and she was carried to where his body was flung on this bleak slope where he had been murdered. And she knelt over him and she scooped up handfuls of his blood and drank it and just started to roar with grief. And so from those roars, this very ancient poetic form called the Quina, the traditional Irish keen, started to come. And that keen that she composed over his body just has such electricity and force of feeling, force of rage and desire and pride in it, that lots of other people in subsequent years grew very fond of it and would recite it. And then other people would learn it by heart and recite it again. And it was through that act of remembering it, learning by heart, reciting it, that it managed to eventually find its way to being transcribed and being published. And that's how it eventually finds its way to us as readers in school and students and, you know, to people who study in university and to me as well. And I just took such comfort in a weird way from this poem, from this other woman's life, and from how extraordinary her voice was. Like, this was a fossil of her actual voice, like of words that she spoke. And I just found that just so cool.
Yeah. But then you went looking for her and she was hard to find, like.
Yeah, well, like, I suppose I'm a total book nerd. So my first stop with that was going to the library. And what I found was that there were books that addressed the poem. There were lots of translations of the poem. And there were sometimes like academic essays or academic books where you could kind of glean a few details here and there. But there was nothing I could find that was like the story of her life. If I had been able to find that book in the library, you know, I would have been quite happy to read it and learn more about her. But I just couldn't find it. So what I realised as time went on was that I was kind of doing research for it unbeknownst to myself. Like, I was going around gathering all these little details about what her life was like, you know. And then there came a certain point where I said to myself, I think I can make a book of this. And that was what I started to try and do.
Yeah. And she was known kind of largely as Daniel O'Connell's aunt, or kind of Artie Lehrer's wife, basically, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, yeah, yeah. Oftentimes when you get a brief biography of her in any of those, like kind of side by side with those translations of her poem to English or any of those brief biographies, that's very often what they mention. And I used to get so cross, or like my nana would say, so vexed over that every time I'd read it. I'd be spitting with rage because there's the idea of this extraordinary poem that's a huge part of our literary canon. I mean, a lot of people would know it immediately at home and would know these things about it and about her, and that she was always, always, always reduced to like, well, who was she in relation to famous men?
Yeah, yeah. So you, it's kind of, it's written in English, but the poem obviously is in Irish, and it is kind of between the two, isn't it? Are you, and the documentary as well is in Irish, are you more yourself in Irish, do you think, or you flip between the two easily?
I flip between the two. English is my first language. I didn't start to learn Irish till I went to school. So when I was four, and my mother tells a really funny story about that. When you go to Gaelscoil, which was the kind of school that I had been sent to, it's immersion education. So kids that age, when they're four, it's like a sponge, you know, you're surrounded completely by Irish. You ask any question and you'll be responded to in Irish, which I love. But I came home after my first day at school.
Yeah.
My mother asked me, how was it? And I said, it was good, but they were all talking rubbish all the time. Just had no idea, you know, that it was Irish. But like by Christmas, I understood everything. And by the end of junior infants, you're speaking Irish, you know. And so I feel really lucky because that was how I came to the language. I have a fluency thanks to the Gaelscoil now, and I don't have any of the hang-ups that a lot of my pals have. Like when I talk to my friends about Irish, they carry a lot of baggage. And like I always say, you know, if I see a picture of Peg, I just think, so cool, wow, you know, what that woman went through, like the hardship she was dealt, and like she created this amazing kind of body of oral literature and everything. I don't have the sense of looking at her and thinking, oh no, Peg, you know, the way that you hear people talk about her. So I'm really glad I kind of don't have those hang-ups. But at the same time, I know it was a privilege to be sent to that kind of school and to be given this into our shared culture without that kind of sense of negativity, you know. And I wish that more people could have that, like, you know.
Yeah, I think you've a lovely mind, though, in fairness. You obviously only see the poetry in the Irish language.
Speaking of that, I have to tell you this. I was thinking about this morning because I had a feeling you might ask me about Irish. And what came back to me, and what often comes back to me when I think about Irish, is this story I was once told about people from the Gaeltacht, from one of the islands. Now, it's vague because I was told the story. God only knows how many other hands that it come to. And when they went to America and they were in one of the cities and they saw the escalator, and they on the spot are coming up with what's the Irish, like how will we refer to this, and they decided to call it Stáire Beo, like a living stairs. And I mean, I love that, and I think the thing about calling it Stáire Beo, a living stairs, instead of like Escalon or some kind of Irish that you might invent for it, is like, you know, it still holds on to that astonishment. Imagine that vision of seeing like a moving stairs and the shock of it.
Yeah.
But for me as well, I think I always am drawn to that story because there's the image of being carried along on those metal steps, like being borne along by a different momentum. That's how I feel when I talk Irish. I'm stepping onto this moving, living stairs that was hewn and made and carried by people who came before us. And I'm stepping onto that and I feel so elevated and carried by it, you know. And I think it's our shared stairs. We all have a space in that language. We all do. We're all welcome there, you know.
Okay, our shared stairs. I love it. So come here, you said in the documentary, I think it was in the documentary, you said you're working on a new kind of history now, more detective work, and this time it's of an institution, which sounds kind of ominous in ways.
Yeah. I didn't think you were going to ask me about this. I'm so early in my next project of writing that I find it hard to almost even put it into words. Like I'm literally writing the first draft, so I don't know how much I can even put into words of it yet. But if A Ghost in the Throat was like a kind of auto-fictional twin biography, say, of two women, of me and of Eileen Dovney Connell, then this is more like a whole choir of characters that were based in an institution at a particular time and attending to each of the biographies of the people in that choir. So it's enormous. It's a huge leap for me. And it's probably going to be 10 years before it sees the light of day. I'd say it's such a huge project, but I'll keep at it anyway, Brendan.
Yeah, yeah, okay, but don't forget to mind the children and do the chores in between, right? Listen, will you read a poem for us?
I will, of course, yeah. And thanks a million for shining light on this documentary. It's going to be shown, it's still shown in cinemas around the country if anyone's interested in it. And it's a great credit to Kieran McCormack, the director of it. We're so delighted with how it turned out.
Yeah, and it's a lovely documentary. It's called Aisling Tree, Nail of or Clouded Reveries. Okay, so what poem are you going to read?
The poem I'm going to read is kind of the opposite of a traditional love poem. So instead of trying to seduce someone with a poem, it's trying to put them off. And it's called At 11:30 in the Mutton Lane Inn, I Am Fire, Slaughter, Dead Starlings. Though this pub is crammed with laughter, I feel your stare. It burns. If you continue, I'll tell you of 1622, when a lightning cloud shadowed this city, flinging sparks on thatch that pulsed to flame. People stumbled over each other through narrow laneways, clutching children to their chests, weeping, afraid, while fire bloomed along the paths where they ran and fell and ran. After the fire, those who survived spoke of the omen of a fortnight before, when two murmurations of starlings clashed in the sky, flinging themselves at each other, high and wild, until small corpses thumped into gutters and ripped wings cobbled the streets, leaving the paths all bird-bloodied, all blush and trembling. For hours, those birds' tiny magnet hearts jerked towards each other as though they couldn't help themselves, in shiver and grasp and shatter, their bodies swooning and falling, falling into each other, a thousand small deaths. Except, listen, in those days, they didn't call them starlings, they called them stares. So you see, I'll say, stares spark fires that can't be quenched. Stares cause children to weep, clutched tight to chests. Turn away, I'll say. Find someone else.
Fantastic. Listen, Dern, there's a great text here. I love the ghost in the throat so much, says Olivia, that I dragged my husband and children to see the grave of Artie Leary in Kilcrae last year when on holidays in Cork. It was a surreal experience. Dern's book resonated with me so much. There is something in our Irish souls that resonates so deeply with the intensity of sorrow. Thank you, Dern, and thank you for last year's book of poetry, which I loved, and that's from Olivia. And
thank
that's it.
Olivia.
We resonate so deeply with the intensity of sorrow. Put that in your pipe and smoke it, Bruce Springsteen. Okay, Dern Ní Grífa, a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks a million. Okay, Slán.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.